Hello and welcome to the September 11th edition of Ukraine Without Hype. I'm Anthony Bardaway, here with my colleague Romeo Kukratsky.
Hi, everyone.
So this episode will begin with our usual battlefield update, and there were some advances. But then Russia really was kind of messing up a lot on the diplomatic front and on the back end that really kind of embarrassed itself. Then, talking about embarrassing themselves, a little bit of news about Elon Musk. After that, we are looking into two kind of semi-profiles. We've been doing a lot of profiles lately. The first of which is about Rustem Umerov. He is the new defense minister who replaced Alexei Reznikov, who resigned after a corruption scandal. And then we're going to be talking a little bit about Igor Kolomoisky, a oligarch who has been on the way out for years now and is once again in legal trouble. Finally, we'll end with a little bit of diplomatic news. So, the battlefield. What's our combat update? Last episode, we talked about the various lines of defense around Robotyna, a village in southern Ukraine, Zaporizhia Oblast, where Ukrainians had finally been able to take the village and started to push the Russian defenses further. We talked about how this was the first line of defense. Well, this offensive has continued, and at a fairly rapid pace, considering the grand scale of things. The Ukrainian forces have already, in some places, pierced parts of the second line of defense. We know for sure that they got through some of the various tank traps, the dragon's teeth, and are now attacking the main trench line in the area. This is, of course, a very challenging battle. The Russians have a little bit of the high ground here, but the Ukrainian forces are, like I said, advancing at a pretty rapid pace compared to the capture of Rotene. There have been some reports of the second line of defense being pierced a little bit more than the dragon's teeth, but only in what appears to be small instances. It is not, you know, a collapse of the Russian lines or anything like that. But going from the first line of defense to already beginning to weaken and in some places get through parts of the second line of defense, it seems like pretty good news all the way around. Next, we'll look at Avdiivka. The Avdiivka front has been pretty static for a while. The Russians got pretty close to encircling the city until the prelude to the counteroffensive. The Ukrainian forces there were able to push the Russians back a bit and give themselves a bit more breathing room. Ukrainian forces have begun to assault and even take parts of the village of Optine, which is south of Avdiivka. And from Avdiivka, it is just north of Donetsk City. It is immediately to the north of the famous Donetsk airport, which saw very fierce and famous fighting in 2014-2015. So this is a push closer to the heart of Russian command and control in Donbass. Very, very, very close to Donetsk. So once they're able to take Optine, they'll be once again facing towards Donetsk Airport and Donetsk City. Looking at Bakhmut, the grind around Bakhmut continues. The northern half of the city has not seen much activity in quite a few weeks now. It's still all around the town of Klishivka, but there is again a large push around Klishivka. It seems as though the Russians are barely holding on to the last few northern blocks of the town. And in my last update, I said that the Ukrainians really hadn't moved in so much into the town, so much as driven the Russians out. But it seems as though the Ukrainians have, in fact, entered the village of Klishivka to a pretty significant extent. If we look north of there at the Kupiansk offensive that the Russians have been trying to do as a way to distract Ukrainian forces from the south, they continue to make extremely little progress, but the word that I have gotten from the soldiers in that area is that it is extremely fierce fighting. They have thus far prevented the Russians from making any advances, though. If they are able to advance further beyond Kupiansk, that could turn into a serious issue in the Kharkiv region. But again, despite a lot of the bragging by Russian propagandists, even a couple weeks ago, there has been no forward movement in this direction. And finally, we don't always talk about every drone attack, every missile attack that hits Ukraine. just because it happens.
There are a lot of them.
Yeah, it happens all the time. It would just be every episode we do are a little bit repetitive with the combat update, just because ultimately the battle is quite slow, so there is repetition. But the missiles, I don't know what to say about that. But in this case, there was one Russian drone that was headed towards Ukraine's ports on the Danube River. During our episode where we talked a bit more in depth about these Danube River ports, I said that the strikes on these ports are only meters away from Romania, a NATO country. Well, it seems like it finally happened. A Russian drone did hit Romanian territory. It seemed as though not any significant damage was done, though there was a video of it causing a fire. At first, the Romanian government tried to downplay this. They denied that it happened. Is also the case that Poland has denied that Russian missiles has hit them, until it turns out that, yes, a few Russian missiles have hit them.
NATO is going to war with Russia. Yeah,
of course. NATO, once again, we're showing that NATO has no interest in war with Russia. Every argument about Russia being afraid of NATO expansion is absolute nonsense, because here we are, yet another NATO country, like Bulgaria, like Czechia, like the United Kingdom, who were attacked by the Russian government and have chosen to take the political route of not leading to direct conflict, even when they could, if they chose to, invoke Article 5 of the NATO treaty. But there's no interest in that. So eventually,
the West doesn't want to go to war with Russia.
Yeah, it's so silly, this accusation that NATO expansion and all that. But anyway, the Romanian government did end up admitting that this attack occurred, but downplayed it, saying that it was just parts of a Russian drone that fell on their territory and did not cause any serious damage. Therefore, they do not consider it a major issue.
Though, in order to, I guess, alleviate some domestic concerns, the Romanian authorities did say that the border regions will be receiving air raid alerts when missiles are launched at the Ukrainian border regions.
With that, yeah, that's smart. Like we said, it's very close to the Ukrainian border regions. Russian weapons are not always so precise. And as we see here, again, like 200 meters, is that what you really want to be trusting? There's also some talk in the Romanian side of evacuating some of this border region. I don't know how far they're willing to go with that. It's not as though Russia is bombing it constantly or anything. This is the only one attack. I don't think they're going to ask people to abandon their homes after a single attack. But it is something they do have to be concerned about, and I don't know how careful Russia is going to be in the future either. Speaking of Russia not being especially careful, we did see them make some diplomatic errors. Romeo, can you talk about some of these?
Yeah, so it turns out that the Russians, facing, let's call it, a staffing issue, have been branching out to allied nations in order to find more meat for the grinder. Cuba was apparently, we are now learning, one of those nations where Russia sent mercenary military recruiters into Cuba to presumably recruit Cubans for the war effort. However, the Cuban government, despite being a pretty consistent Russian ally, was not apparently informed nor in favor of this plan, with the Cuban government announcing that it had busted a human trafficking ring, this is what they call these Russian mercenaries. Cuba has claimed that it arrested 17 quote-unquote human traffickers, including the organizer. So this is probably a mix of both Russian nationals and Cuban nationals. And they're throwing the book at these guys. This isn't a slap of the wrist, or at least the charges that they're facing are not a slap in the wrist. They're facing either a life sentence to the death penalty. They're being charged with human trafficking and fighting as a mercenary, which is apparently illegal under Cuban law, and hostile action against a foreign state. In this case, I'm assuming they mean Ukraine. which is pretty a pretty harsh stance to take against what is likely an authorized operation, at least by the Russian side. It's hard to imagine that some guys just randomly went to Cuba to hire mercenaries without clearing it with someone in Russia's MOD.
Yeah, as much as Cuba might be Russia-friendly to a certain extent, ultimately their national interests are to get America to finally drop the embargo against them. There have been diplomatic...
And they likely don't want to normalize forcibly seizing land.
Yeah. They were invaded,
a small island surrounded by the greatest empire on Earth.
Yeah, being invaded is not really in their interest, but they have been making pretty good strides with the United States government to normalize relations, and being a direct Russian ally and supplying Russia with soldiers and watching it happen and allowing it to happen is not in Cuba's economic interest. They do want to figure this out. And really kind of turning back the clock to the Cold War is the worst way to stitch up relations with the United States, even if really that strained relationship for the past, since the end of the Cold War, has been more America's fault than theirs, but that's a whole other issue. But Russia has really been reaching out to a lot of other countries to try and fill in the gaps where it is missing things. And right now, they're very much in the process of getting North Korea more on side. There's going to be a meeting between Putin and Kim Jong-un?
Yes, according to the Financial Times, Jong-un is apparently all but ready to close a arms deal with Putin. He's planning to travel to Vladivostok, I suppose overland, which will be one of Jong-un's very rare foreign trips. He doesn't travel much, as for obvious reasons, I think. And while it's not clear exactly what the arms deal would consist of, it's likely it's going to mostly involve ammo, artillery shortages, as we've mentioned many times before, are one of the driving challenges in the war for both sides, despite the fact that Russia has many, many more shells than Ukraine. That number isn't infinite, and they shoot many, many more shells at Ukraine, then Ukraine shoots back. So it's likely that Russia is looking to tap into North Korea's stockpile of Soviet-era munitions to top up their own capabilities.
Yes, we kind of slotted this in as an embarrassment. It can in other way be seen as a diplomatic victory in that they're able to secure these other supplies, but going to North Korea hat in hand, it's not a great look.
It doesn't make you look strong and a global leader.
Yeah, North Korea does have a very formidable supply of artillery shells and artillery weaponry in order to have a war with South Korea at some point, which is why I think that they not be entirely willing to give up too much of their supply, seeing as how the existence of their regime is based on being able to threaten South Korea with mass amounts of artillery. So, yeah, they have to calculate how much of that they're willing to sacrifice in order to support Russia. But, I mean, it is still North Korea. And as much as they may represent this large warehouse, a warehouse as a country, they are still not treated as like the most serious people in the world. And having to grovel to the Hermit Kingdom as the czar is not something that I think that a Russian would have been thinking about much a few years ago.
I also want to note that while on paper, North Korea does have large amounts of Korean War era supplies and also later Soviet supplies, it is not unlikely that a lot of what they have on paper, just like Russia, does not really exist in practice or is not in the best of shape. One of the ways that North Korea has financed itself for all this time beyond offering ground to cartels to create heroin and kidnapping Japanese sushi chefs, has been the sale of arms to countries that can otherwise not obtain them. And knowing the corruption inherent in dictatorial regimes, it's very likely that a lot of their vaunted supplies and stockpiles are less impressive than thought.
And of course, if we cut down their not great supply of weapons, that's even more they have to worry about how much they can give away to Russia as opposed to keeping it for themselves or selling it to someone else. But yeah, Russia has entered the same arms market as, you know, African warlords, not superpowers. And the last bit of Russian news that we have for you regards audio medium. Imagine me throwing quotes up in the air right now. The Russian elections. Russia, not a democracy, but it does have elections, whatever they actually lead to. I mean, there's all kind of Kremlinologists, Russiaologists who are able to explain that Russian elections can be used as signaling. But even then, in these elections, do you even hear anything about much of anything? In the previous few, the big story was about how Alexei Navalny was kind of electioneering math ways to decrease the power of the United Russia Party. Now, of course, he is in jail, not long for this world, most likely, and there is none of this strategic voting happening. I was able to pick up some like minor stories of officials in different parts of the country kind of becoming half a referendum on the war or the officials withdrawing war veterans from the ballot because they don't want it to be a referendum on the war, which having a veteran running would turn it into. So just to avoid that whole mess of people being able to give their opinions on the war, they just remove that as a possibility. But as regarding Ukraine, it also means that Russia has been holding these elections in the territories of Ukraine that they consider to be part of Russia. So Zaporizhia Oblast, Kherson Oblast, Donbass, and Crimea. They have really been pushing forward, making sure these polling stations are open, though, of course, with extremely low voter turnout, as you can imagine why. I'm sure not many of the people there are very, very thrilled to vote in Russian elections, even though there's video going around of Russian election officials literally going to people's houses and commanding people to go vote.
Because that's how democracy works.
Yes, right? That is how democracy, to have a black van pull up to your house and say, house number so-and-so, go vote.
And if you are curious, that is not dissimilar to how the so-called Crimean referendum was held.
Yep, it's all at the point of threats, either explicit or implicit, of life, property, limb, whatever the case may be. It is backed up with threat. And to make it even more bizarre that they're holding these elections in occupied Ukrainian territory, they've actually suspended elections in parts of Belgorod Oblast and other areas along the Ukrainian border where it is considered unsafe to hold elections due to the threat of Ukrainian attack. So apparently it is too dangerous in Belgorod to hold elections, which, fair, yes, that does make sense, but it is safe enough in their Potemkin-occupied governments to hold elections.
To provide a reason for this, the Russian kind of strategy for, let's say, integrating the occupied territories is basically one of wearing down the spirit, to present what is an ongoing act as a fait accompli, and to morally and psychologically pressure people into accepting that they are part of Russia. These elections are a part of that strategy, just as passportization is. Just as implementing and reopening schools and forcing schools to go over to the Russian educational system and curriculum, it's all part of the kind of Russian strategy for assimilating these occupied territories. They want people to accept psychologically that they are in Russia and they will never go back to Ukraine.
Yeah, and like I said, it's all an entire joke. They're not putting any effort into even faking the outcome of the election right now. At least historically, they're willing to allow people to, you know, come to the polls, get the feeling of voting, and then kind of, you know, sanding off the sharp edges later on. In this case, it is the polling stations have nobody in them, and they're just going to make up the result no matter what, which is what they did with Even in Crimea, they tried to put in some effort to making it look like a referendum, even if they ended up scrubbing the results anyway. And now it's complete nonsense. But on the other side of that, the Ukrainian partisans have not been taking this attack on Ukraine lightly. There have been many Russian election officials, many party offices, United Russia party offices, who have been attacked and had their property and lives destroyed by these Ukrainian partisans who are not willing to accept this humiliation from the Russian occupier. But
speaking of
accepting humiliation by the Russian occupier, yeah, that's our transition on good transitions today. Elon Musk. So this is news that we kind of knew about already, that he had been choking off Starlink, Starlink being the satellite internet, a pretty advanced satellite internet, better than what you're probably used to, that's very expensive and very slow. Starlink has been quite important from the Ukrainian war effort to get internet connection in places on the front line, especially that are far away from cell phone towers and the like. So we knew that Elon was very concerned about the use of Starlink in a war setting, even though he was literally paid by the United States Defense Department in order to provide internet for the Ukrainian military. He's more than willing to take the money for such things, then complain about it later. So we know that he was shutting down access from time to time, that he did not want Starlink access to cover Crimea or for offensive operations, though hearing from a lot of soldiers, often it was the case that they still had Starlink anyway. But in this case, in this particular instant, there was a naval drone attack. We talked about these naval drones last episode, planned to destroy elements of the Russian Black Sea fleet near Sevastopol. These seaborne drones were on the way to destroy these ships, but they were relying on Starlink for communication. However, when they almost reached their target, their internet connection was cut off and just kind of scuttled ashore. There was news a while ago of drones just appearing on the shore of Crimea unexploded. So they failed in this attack, and it turned out that Elon Musk made the decision in order to turn off the Starlink access to Crimea, despite the area being known to have access prior.
To put this in perspective, Elon Musk personally took part in a military operation or interfered in a military operation in favor of the enemy.
Yes. Elon Musk made a decision to protect the Russian fleet. He personally made this specific decision because he knew that this attack was about to take place, and he decided it should not take place.
Now, and this isn't hearsay. This comes from the horse's mouth itself. Elon tweeted this exact the exact chain of events and provided his reasoning, which he claimed was because he fears nuclear war.
We need a whole explainer to describe why that's stupid, but it's stupid. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it is not his decision. He is a private citizen who sold a product. He's not a man in charge of foreign policy. He's not a commander in the Ukrainian military. It is not his place to make these decisions. And he is still allowed to be a defense contractor after just nigh committing treason.
Like, yeah, there's
also, this is very treasony territory.
There's an aspect to this whole thing as well, in that Musk claimed that the day before he had a phone call with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. And this is not the first time Musk has had personal conversations with Russian officials. We don't know what they talk about in these conversations. We don't know what is said, what is thought about, what the tone is. We know nothing about these. Now, Musk claims that he is, quote unquote, scared of nuclear war. But we have no idea what the actual reasoning is beyond Musk's word. And again, Musk has spoken to the enemy. Were they impressing on him that they were going to nuke Texas if Musk did not shut off this attack? Or were there other concerns? There's no way to know. There's no way to know. What we do know, what is verifiable, and again, verified by the man himself, is that a foreign citizen interfered in a Ukrainian military operation on behalf of the Russian authorities.
We have known these kind of things were happening in that we knew that he was talking to Russian officials. Yes. We knew that he had he was basically watching Ukrainian military activity through Starlink activity. But we did not really have a way to piece these two together in a concrete way. But now we have proof of him interfering after speaking to Russia. And nationalize Starlink? It is not the kind of thing that should be in the hands of any billionaire, let alone a billionaire working with the Russian government and who has his own bizarre megalomaniacal ideas about how to run the world. Minimum, he should have his defense contracting businesses nationalized or handed over to someone who will be more responsible with this task. And maximum, this should be considered espionage or treason or something illegal.
Now, in the interest of balance, I will say that Musk did walk back his initial admission of what he did and subsequently claimed, after people started talking about the whole treason thing, that Musk, that he did not deactivate Starlink as not activate it after the Ukrainian government requested them to do so. Now, that is a new claim that he did not initially make. He's presenting this as a clarification, but it actually contradicts some of his earlier statements. He said that he did not want to be complicit in escalating the conflict, whatever that means. And again, we know that he has spoken to Russian officials, including Lavrov, including even Putin. So what is the truth in this case? Well, as far as we can tell, that is verifiable. Ukraine did attempt to launch a naval drone attack on the Russian Black Sea fleet. That attack failed, and it's likely it failed because the drones lost internet connectivity and thus were rendered jammed in all aspects. And of course, the Russians continue to use the Black Sea fleet to threaten and attack Ukrainian soil.
We also have heard from Ukrainian officials that they were kind of aware of this issue with Starlink. It's hard to kind of lose it, and that they have been trying to decrease their reliance on it. I suspect that the recent successes of Ukrainian naval drones in the Black Sea are likely somewhat the result of being less reliant on Starlink and going their own way, I would have to assume, although I have no real way of knowing that that's specifically the case. Although presidential administration official Mykhailo Podolyak has also confirmed that this attack being stalled out did cost civilian lives. He did not specify how many or which attack specifically, but we know that these ships that Elon made the choice to defend are being used to kill Ukrainian civilians. And by allowing those ships to continue to exist, Elon was complicit in the killing of Ukrainian civilians. So we talked about one person we don't like, and now we'll talk about someone who we have a bit of hope for. At least I have a bit of hope for, speaking for myself. So last episode, we were talking about the scandal in the defense ministry about the improper purchases of jackets and how the previous defense minister, Reznikov, had gotten to some hot water thanks to a few other scandals and very much not handling it well in the press, which I think was his ultimate undoing. He could have handled it a lot better and probably been fine. During that episode, Romeo said that he would have a week left in his defense ministry. And that turned out to be correct almost to the day. So good job, Romeo. You really called that one.
It's almost like I'm a trained journalist.
Yeah, good job. Reznikov was asked to resign from his position and was replaced with one Rustem Umerov. Rustem Umerov is a very interesting person, so we'll be going over his biography a bit to kind of explain what he means to Ukraine and make some predictions from his background of what strengths he's bringing to the table and could possibly improve upon in the ministry. So Umerov was born in Uzbekistan. He is a Crimean Tatar. He is a Muslim, which is something that has been pointed out, that Ukraine has a Jewish president and a Muslim defense minister. And, you know,
I think it's the first time in human history that there has been a Jewish leader and a Muslim minister in cabinet. I don't think this has ever happened before.
You might be able to, like, finesse some things with maybe the Khazar Khaganate or something in the Middle Ages, but in terms of, you know, modern states, yes, a Muslim and a Jew sharing power like this is quite rare. What I know from Israel, which is one of the few other countries where this kind of thing could happen, they have had lower level ministers. So like a minister of culture they had was a Muslim Arab at one point. They very briefly had a Druze president for about 2 weeks. Druze are similar to Islam. They have some, you know, connection there, but aren't. But yes, I do believe that this is the first time that the number one guy is a Jew and the number two or three, depending on how you look at the Ukrainian government guy, is a Muslim. It's interesting from that perspective. So Umerov was born in Uzbekistan, like I said, because like the rest of the Crimean Tatar people during the extension of the Soviet Union, Crimean Tatars were not allowed to live in Crimea. They were expelled by Stalin and were not allowed back even after other nationalities expelled from their homes, such as the Chechens, were allowed back. Tatars were considered, Crimea was considered too sensitive and important of an area to allow anyone other than good, loyal Russians to live in. You know, draw your own conclusions from that. With Ukrainian independence, his family moved back to Ukraine, back to Crimea, and they were a bit of an industrious family. He was able to go on the Flex program. Some of our listeners are probably familiar with this. It is a State Department funded program to bring high school students from mostly the former Soviet Union. I'm not quite sure where it extends beyond that, but I know a few different people from Ukraine, a few different people from Russia, Belarus, elsewhere, Georgia, who have been on this Flex program where you go and stay with an American family for a year and you're supposed to learn about how great America is and you're supposed to go through education. And the idea is to have those leaders go back home and push their countries in a more liberal direction. That's the idea of it. And I guess in this case, it's bearing fruit. So our little international Umerov goes to America, spends some time in America until going back and getting into the telecoms industry. So phone companies, he starts a company himself, and he and his family are business people, and he kind of joins their tradition and becomes quite successful in this way. He becomes a leader among the Crimean Tatar community, partially because of his business success and his connections with the outside world, including the United States, and takes a important position leading a bunch of NGOs. A very long list of different NGOs and civil society organizations. I'm not going to go through them, but civil rights organizations, support for the poor, education opportunities. His family rebuilt a mosque that had been in disuse for 70 years, the Orta Sami Mosque in Bakhchisarai, Bakhchisarai being probably the most important city for the Crimean Tatars. Communal exchange, you know, getting Muslims to talk to Christians, that kind of thing. Just an all around, you know, the kind of community leader guy that you see often. But in this case, you know, pretty big deal because of his community connections, because he is a successful businessman. He goes into politics. He becomes a delegate to the Crimean Tatar Kurultai. The Kurultai is the legislature, I suppose, of the Crimean Tatars. Every few years, they hold this congress where they make the important decisions. Then in between these congresses, the Mejlis is the parliament who runs the day-to-day in between the Kurultais. He is a delegate to a Kurultai and eventually becomes an advisor to Mustafa Jamilev, who is one of the leaders of the Mejlis. I'm not quite sure what his official position is at the moment. They kind of shift around, but Mustafa Jamilev, if you know the Crimean Tatar community, you know Jamilev. He is a very charismatic person. He's very, very important in that community. And Umerov becomes his protege. And also, as you know, Crimean Tatar leader, he does eventually get elected to the Ukrainian parliament, the Verkhovna Rada. And through that, he becomes the co-chair of the Crimea Platform. Crimea Platform is basically the plan of the Ukrainian government of what will happen after they retake Crimea. They're going to restore the rights of the Crimean Tatar people, promote Crimean Tatar media, that kind of thing. It's a big program. We've talked about it a few times in the past. And they actually just had a meeting of the Crimea Platform on Independence Day or Independence Day week. It's delegates from all over the world, the United States, different heads of government, foreign ministries have collaborated with Crimea Platform to make these decisions. The Crimea Platform is also partially responsible for the indigenous rights law. And that says that the Crimean Tatars, the Krimchak Jews, and the Karaim Jews are the quote-unquote indigenous people of Ukraine. Again, we've had an episode about this, but it is a very important and well-written law. And Umerov, as the co-chair of the Crimea Platform, is partially responsible for it. So everything I just said, put together as a guy who very much represents the best interests, the civil rights, the economic interests of the Crimean Tatar people, and is recognized as such in Ukraine. He is a deliberate decision to put someone who's so important to Crimean Tatars in, again, the number two or three, depending on how you see it, position of government.
Yeah, this is the guy that is widely seen and understood to be one of the driving figures of repatriating Crimean prisoners from Russia. He's been one of the main people who has led that direction, and he has really pushed forward Crimean rights and Crimean issues at Parliament. He is one of the main figures there. So it's difficult to overstate how big of a signal this does send to the Crimean Tatar community.
Precisely. And with his being one of the delegates to negotiate with Russia for prisoner exchange, he was able to bring a few Crimean Tatar political prisoners to Ukraine to safety through his efforts. And during the war has been a delegate discussing prisoner exchanges with Russia directly. So he is very much a diplomat as well, which Reznikov, the outgoing defense minister, although his tenure did end in scandal, he was very much known as a very successful diplomat as a defense minister, and they needed someone who could do that same role. And Rustem Umerov very much does fill that role. But elsewhere in his political career, he joined the Rada as a member of the Holos Party. Now, the Holos Party is basically the liberal party in Ukraine. Ukrainian political parties are not overly ideological, but Holos is, you know, the kind of the party for the kind of educated middle class Kievite liberal LGBT friendly kind
pro-EU.
Pro-EU kind of folks.
Yeah, they were never a big force, but they were founded by Sviatoslav Vakarchuk, who is the lead singer of the rock group Okean Elza, which our listeners might be familiar with. It's an incredibly famous and popular Ukrainian rock group that's gotten international recognition and quite a lot of it. And as a result, Hulos was immediately kind of catapulted to having a much, much bigger influence than its relatively small amount of MPs would argue. And Hulos is seen as one of the few parties in Ukraine that is resolutely ideological, in this case, liberal.
A lot of the people that from Hulos were Maidan activists. Vakarchuk was a Maidan activist. His dad was, you know, a dissident in Soviet times. So it's connected that to that political tradition as well. So him joining the Hulos party is also a signal of his more liberal attitudes that are, I like Hulos party in general because of their liberalism, but it's good that it's interesting that he does come from there. But the other interesting thing here as an electoral note is during that election, the Crimean Tatar community kind of made a decision to offer all political parties a Crimean Tatar on their list. They wanted a seat in every house, basically, and he's the one who went to Hulos. Others went, you know, European Solidarity and all the other parties as well, but he went to Hulos. As a lawmaker, he's been extremely active, again, talking about IDP rights, and he was also the person who wrote or co-sponsored a lot of the legislation around COVID relief, about, you know, payments to people who lost their job, that kind of thing. He drafted a lot of those laws. He was also, again, this whole idea of a diplomat. He was a delegate to the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, where, again, he had a lot of dealings with foreign politicians and is good dealing with that. During the war, he has been head of the State Property Fund. The State Property Fund is basically the government institution in charge of privatization. They oversee,
aka one of the most corrupt government organs.
Yes,
that Ukraine
to has. Be in charge of the State Property Fund, to be in charge of the actual property owned by the government, and there is still quite a lot, even from Soviet times.
It's estimated that the Ukrainian government owns about 3,600 separate enterprises.
Yes, it's a big fund. And to be in charge of this is a remarkable extension of trust, or it can be an ultimate payoff in bribery. I am not aware of there being an overly large number of scandals in the State Property Fund in recent times. Maybe you can correct me on that, Romeo.
Not since he took office. His predecessor was dismissed basically a couple of days prior to the full-scale war, and he was only appointed in September. So there's a good 6 months there where they were kind of scrambling to find someone to fill the gap. But since his about year of work, since he was only in the role for about a year before he got bumped up to defense minister, according to the Anti-Corruption Action Center, one of Ukraine's leading anti-corruption NGOs, they say that his work has been exemplary at the fund, that despite the fact that it just has been for 30 straight years one of the most corrupt government organs in the country. He has actually worked more or less transparently. He's fulfilled his mandate to sell off illiquid and fake enterprises. And he did not buy himself a new Lexus or a villa in France. So it seems like he has legitimately done his job at this incredibly, incredibly corrupt agency.
Yeah, it seems like we're damning with faint praise there, but honestly, yes, actually,
no, that is it is. Yeah, I really want to make it clear. It is incredibly impressive that he has managed to, quite frankly, do anything with the State Property Fund, the kind of institution of corruption that has existed there was so ingrained that it was difficult to imagine it ever existing without being corrupt. And the fact that he did his job is nothing short of awe-inspiring, to be honest.
Yeah, and ultimately we do have to kind of give the nod to people who pay closer attention to such things. ANTAC, the Anti-Corruption Action Center, gives him good marks. He seems to be pretty popular within civil society. Of course, he does come from the Holos Party, and the Holos Party is kind of the party of civil society, so that does make sense. So considering that the big problem with the defense ministry was these corruption scandals, putting someone in charge who has the good record of at least stemming the tide of corruption, if not eliminating it, is the exact kind of person they wanted in the role. So they wanted someone who can kind of get the corruption there under control before it becomes a bigger problem. There has been complaints from Lithuania, for example, that said that they were concerned about their aid going to corrupt pockets. And I think that a lot of these issues are on the overblown side. We have not seen grand corruption on a serious scale. We have not seen, you know, Ukraine selling off its arms supplies that it's being given that has been accused of, for example. But nonetheless, anti-corruption is extremely important, especially considering the limited amount of resources in order to do something like absolutely existentially vital. There's no room for error, and they need someone who can clamp down on it. And it seems like he is capable of doing that, which gets into the other things that are expected out of him, other than, so this anti-corruption idea is number one, but also, of course, focus on Crimea. He is someone intimately connected with the cause of the Crimean Tatar people. He himself, among them, defending their rights, representing them on a political and international level. So him being in charge in such a key ministry is a way of saying we have not forgotten Crimea. That is our goal. We will liberate Crimea. We will bring justice to the Crimean Tatar people. And if you're going to tell us, no, we can't do that, you have to say it to the face of someone who has suffered under Russian genocidal policy against the Crimean Tatars. You have to say that directly to his face, that you don't believe that his family is worth it. And as much as politics is political, politics is also personal. And being able to say that to someone who's directly affected is harder to do than two people with no connection just chatting in their leather chairs and whiskey glasses. This is also on the backdrop of another round of crackdowns in Crimea against Crimean Tatar people. Lots of arrests, tortures, the whole deal. More attention has to be given to Crimea. And now that the Ukrainian military is making moves on the peninsula itself, it cannot be forgotten. But one matter of his diplomacy is especially crucial, I think. Umerov has very close ties with Turkish business interests. A lot of his activities in Crimea, before Russians ever invaded that, was dealing with Turkish investors into Crimean Tatar causes. He's close with the business community there. He has ears in the government listening to him, which means that he is good at dealing with Turkey. He has gone through Turkey for diplomatic purposes, fundraising purposes, every other kind of purpose. He is a specialist in dealing with Turkey. And Crimean Tatars are a Turkic-speaking people, so there is another cultural connection there that leads to Turkey feeling a bit more protective of the Crimean Tatars, even when they are otherwise not the best allies in the world. And them not being the best allies in the world is especially the point. There was recently a meeting between the leader of Turkey, Erdogan, and Putin. And in this, Erdogan tried to get Putin to go back to the grain deal, and he goes back and forth a lot in his cozy relationships between Russia and the West. He's trying to play all sides. If there's that, you know, meme going around on Twitter every once in a while of, you know, a dating app saying, oh, you're Ukrainian, right? You're Russian. I'm Turkey. Turkey's friends with Russia. Then the person responding, I'm Ukrainian. Oh, you're Ukrainian. Turkey's friends with Ukraine. And the answer is yes, they are. They play both sides. And as bad of an ally as Turkey is, they are a very crucial ally. Nothing can get done without Turkey. That is very frustrating considering how much they play both sides, by how cozy they are with Russia often, how they switch between coziness with Russia and competition with Russia, and basically doing their own thing apart from NATO and the West.
They did threaten after the Russia didn't renew the grain agreement that they would escort cargo ships in the Black Sea, regardless of what Russia did. I mean, they didn't act on it, but they did make the threat.
And they did shoot down that Russian fighter a few years ago. So they are very much frenemies.
That is more than most countries have done.
Honestly, yes, it's a very interesting foreign policy they run. And Ukraine needs their fingers on the scale in Ankara, and Umerov is that weight on the scale. And I think that's very important. Moving on to another famous Ukrainian, although there's a question if he is still Ukrainian, Igor Kolomoisky. Igor Kolomoisky is one of the main oligarchs in Ukraine. He is a bit of the lord of the Dnipropetrovsk region. He invested a lot into Dnipro City, especially the Jewish community there. He owns a lot of interest in that region. He is a bit of, you know, the lord of Dnipro in a way. But he's also run afoul of anti-corruption, of fraud investigators, of financial crimes investigators, not only in Ukraine, but also several other countries, including the United States. His oligarch activities extended all the way to Cleveland, where he bought up a lot of that city's industry and kind of let it rot. He is a controversial figure, to say the least. But he was a controversial figure who was also pretty key in the political rise in Volodymyr Zelensky. Volodymyr Zelensky, we all know he's an actor, a comedian. Well, he did so on the channel 1+1, which was owned by Kolomoisky. There's a lot of talk during the election that Zelensky was some kind of puppet political figure of Kolomoisky, which was really the main criticism leveled against him. There were not a whole lot of criticisms during the election, but people were afraid that he would just be a puppet of Kolomoisky. Well, shortly after that election, that turned out not to be the case, because Kolomoisky has spent most of that time in some kind of legal limbo. There was a rumor a few months ago that Kolomoisky was even stripped of his Ukrainian citizenship. The basis of this is that he is actually a triple citizen. He is a citizen of Ukraine, Cyprus, and Israel. In the past, he joked about the law that bans people from having a double citizenship and to be an official by saying, "I'm not a double citizen, I'm a triple citizen," and, you know, rule lawyer that around. But yeah, so he's been spending a lot of time in legal trouble. He's being investigated in the United States and is wanted for arrest there. He is under sanction. It's for money laundering, for fraud. And then on September 2nd, he was served with new charges. So he was served with his arrest. He was offered bail. He declined to pay that bail. And so is going to be, I guess, in jail. He's in jail until whatever court date happens. And court dates are not quick to happen. So, I mean, we don't have much of a grand narrative to this, but Igor Kolomoisky, one of the most powerful people in the country, in fact, so powerful that the war in 2014, 2015, he was kind of responsible for saving, in a way. His money was responsible for funding several volunteer battalions that protected the country, which kind of bought him protection from a lot of the criminal charges that were headed his way. For example, when he was found to have been embezzling all the money from the largest bank in the country, which he owned, Privat, which is now under public ownership instead. This former extremely powerful person is now, and who is very much partially responsible for the rise of Zelensky, is now in jail and possibly might even be extradited to the United States if it is indeed true that he was stripped of his Ukrainian citizenship. If that's true, then he might also be sent to the United States for trial as well. I don't.
There's another aspect here which kind of touches on the war, he also owned pretty much outright Ukrtatnafta, which was Ukraine's largest refinery. So in the initial phases of the war, the Russians launched massive missile attacks against most of Ukraine's kind of refining and oil infrastructure to deprive the country of fuel, to deprive the military of fuel. And in response, most of Ukraine's oil and gas companies started giving, providing these products to the government, to the military at heavily discounted rates. However, Ukrtatnafta, which again was owned outright by Kolomoisky, refused to do so. This actually resulted in the Ukrainian government nationalizing both Ukrnafta and Ukrtatnafta outright. Kolomoisky claims he wasn't compensated for this at all. It's an illegal seizure, blah, blah, blah. But that particular episode really seemed to piss off Zelensky. By all accounts, it seemed that Zelensky took Kolomoisky's kind of refusal to play ball here very personally. And as a result, the kind of legal, not quite harassment, because all the charges are based in evidence against him. But Kolomoisky's legal troubles really started ramping up after this episode. And the current charges that he was actually arrested on also relate to a fossil fuel company, in this case, Neftechimik Prikarpatia, which is an oil products company. They make products, chemical products out of oil. He was the majority shareholder in that company, but the Ukrainian government owned a minority stake, a 26% minority stake in the company as well. Which again means that if the alleged fraud is true, that Kolomoisky defrauded this company that he owned to the tune of, I believe the government is claiming $27 million, then he will again have damaged Ukrainian state interests. And at the moment, the Zelensky administration is not really taking a soft hand to violations of state sovereignty. They seem to be rather touchy on that matter. So Kolomoisky's kind of involvement and the source of his riches really were built on this fossil fuel empire, and it seems that it has not worked out for him. Though one can note that fellow fossil fuel oligarch Renat Akhmetov has not faced the same legal troubles as Kolomoisky has, despite being as involved in the in Ukraine's fossil fuel industry, or even more involved. But by all accounts, Akhmetov's companies have all played ball with the Ukrainian government, and they have given the Ukrainian government huge discounts or straight up funding or provided products for free. So Zelensky is clearly sending a message to Ukraine's remaining oligarchs of how they should be acting.
Yeah, you can't really look at this as just a straightforward anti-corruption thing, because if Kolomoisky had played ball, then it's likely that his legal problems would at least be swept under the table. But at least the deal here is, if you're an you can't get rid of the oligarchs overnight, unfortunately. But what you can do is say that the oligarchs have to support their country at minimum. And if they can't do that, then the legal system will be unleashed on them, and they're going to be guilty of something.
Yeah, there's 0% chance that you are rich in Ukraine without being guilty of something. Now, it's possible that some of Ukraine's nouveau rich that made their fortunes in the tech center did not have to pay that many bribes, that they would be damned by their actions. But it is a given fact that all of the old school oligarchs that made their fortunes in real estate, in fossil fuels, in finance, that all of those guys are dirty to hell and back.
And Renat Akhmetov and his journey from pro-Russian mobster politician to a pretty strong Ukrainian loyalist at this point, we can say, is a fascinating one, and one we should definitely look at in the future. But moving on to our last topic, some diplomatic actions happening in Kyiv. We've had a lot of foreign dignitaries recently, including the great Stephen Fry, the British comedian and wordsmith, There's also the First Ladies and Gentlemen Summit on the 6th. So the wives and husbands of the presidents and prime ministers of various countries, they came together to their topic was mental health, fragility, and resilience of the future, which is, of course, a very important topic. A lot of people in Ukraine, present company included, are probably not the best mentally at the moment and likely won't be in the future. So there needs to be solutions found for how to better handle the mental health of the people of Ukraine, and some very direct interventions needed, especially for children who are growing up in the early years of their life in true horror. So that needs to be solved, and it is the kind of topic that First Ladies and First Gentlemen are often involved in. It's very much in their wheelhouse. There were the wife of Erdogan, Emine Erdogan, Cyprus, Belize, interestingly, a lot of countries. It's a very long list. But the one that stood out to me was Anna Hakobyan, the wife of Armenian leader Nikol Pashinyan. We've been talking throughout episodes. We had an interview in a previous episode about the situation in Armenia. Go back and listen to that. About how
it's gotten worse.
It is definitely getting worse. The Azeri government is threatening to invade the country. They're lining up their army as we speak, actually. And the people of Nagorno-Karabakh, whatever political opinions you may have of that situation, are quite literally starving. They are trying to scrape together whatever scraps of bread they can find. It is horrifying. Armenia has strongly criticized Russia, who's supposed to be the security guarantor of the South Caucasus, and their failure to prevent Azerbaijan from doing these things. And recently, Armenia even announced they will be doing joint military exercises with the United States, a fact that Russia was very, very unhappy about. While in
Kiev, do literally nothing about.
And yes, Russia is doing nothing to prevent Armenia from being attacked, despite being treaty allies.
And this is amid Azerbaijani rhetoric, which has, again, they're lining up their army as we speak, and their rhetoric has extended beyond simply retaking Nagorno-Karabakh to wiping out all of Armenia.
I saw today one Azerbaijan official literally say that we may have to commit genocide. Like, he used the word genocide.
Yeah, they're not being coy about their motivations. And if the Russian full-scale invasion has taught us anything, it's that when people say that they are preparing to commit genocide, it's usually wise to believe them, that they are preparing to commit genocide.
They usually don't even directly say genocide. The Azerbaijan, name's escaping me right now. I'm kind of going off the top of my head. I just saw it recently, but he literally said, we may have to do genocide. It might be for the best. So yeah, pay attention to this, please. We've been kind of raising the alarm here, but we only have so much of an audience. So it's bad. It's really, really bad. But point being, the First Lady of Armenia was in Kiev and did promise Ukraine humanitarian aid while their country is bracing itself for its own war of near annihilation, possibly. Armenia did step in and promise Ukraine aid. This is a very bold move. Like I said, they're supposed to be an ally of Russia in the Collective Security Treaty Organization, though that obviously failed them. And right now they're trying desperately to break away from the Russian sphere of influence. And part of that is promising to aid Ukraine with humanitarian. I'm not going to expect them to, you know, send soldiers or something, but Russia interpreted this the same way I did and announced a lot of very harsh denunciations of Armenia for aiding the enemy. So this realignment that we have been talking about, like, over time, for probably before most of you have even been listening to this podcast, this reorientation is underway, and part of that involves helping Ukraine. This very nice gesture of theirs.
Yeah, it's likely if there's a while this is a moderate diplomatic signal, it is a diplomatic signal nonetheless. It probably indicates more active negotiations behind the scenes. And of course, we don't know how things will shake out. But I do want to note that there are likely more Armenians in Ukraine than there are Azerbaijanis. And while there is an Azerbaijani diaspora in Ukraine, it is much smaller and more business oriented. They have a very strong business community here, and especially in real estate. But there are a good amount of Armenians in Ukraine that would likely not take kindly to Ukraine simply ignoring what's going on in Armenia and what Azerbaijan is doing.
And it's also interesting to point out that the first of the named Heavenly Hundred, the people who gave their lives on the Maidan, was a Armenian refugee from the Nagorno-Karabakh War of the 90s, Serhiy Mikhonyan. So that connection between Ukraine and Armenia is has always been there, as well as, of course, the connection with Azerbaijan. It's all a web of relationships that are often quite complicated. It is not a one-directional thing. Russia is also the main supplier of the Azeri military and is a ally with the Azeri government. It's not just a matter of Armenia being on Team Russia and Azerbaijan being on Team NATO. That is an absurd oversimplification that does not make any sense whatsoever. It's much more complicated and intertwined relationship than that. But that is all of our news for the week. If you would like to support Ukraine more broadly, please go to our link tree in the description to find various Ukrainian charities and sources of information. If you'd like to support us directly, you may go to patreon.com/ukrainewithouthype and join one of our tiers. You would join our Discord channel. We've been enjoying our Discord channel. We're trying to expand some of our content offerings in the near future. And so if you're in our Discord, you'll be the first people asked about that. You'll contribute to the growth of this channel. So please, you know, like and subscribe, rate us, review us, 5 stars, thumbs up, that whole deal wherever you're listening. And I would now like to thank our patrons. So thank you very much to Devorah Grazer, William, David Shepard, Dawson, Giorgio, Ivana Kukrutskaya, Michael Drucker, Anna Karen Person, Anonymous, Betakan, Dennis Napalm, Devi, Dimitri Litvin, Etienne Soleil, Jan, Jenny Louise, Justin Devendorf, Kevin Alberton, Michael Wickman, Mike Perrone, Sander Bongers, Shieldwall, T. Bart, Vivek, Adam Poppenheimer, Ada McDonald, Alex Grochmal, Anastasia, Barbara, Big Rob, Captain Technical, Chris Bennington, Crystal Burns, Daniel Spring, David Wall, Emily Bavona, Eric Honnold, Grace Krause, Had to Laugh, Jacob Hoem, James Wise, Jerd, Julia Lindsay, Laura De Leon, Levy Grove, Marguerite, Marianne, Matt Miller, Melissa Koselko, another anonymous, Noam Hart, Paul Bailey, Randy McNerlin, RDK, Sanjay, Scott Berry, Scott Gengris, Scott Tarkiuk, Steve Bien, Stuart Akers, Subtle Knife, Thomas Sobiek, Veronica, Victoria Leontineva, and Wandering Lens. Thank you all very much. You're what make this all possible. And until next week, Slava Ukraini.
Heroim Slava. Hey,